Professors FM.
Hey, welcome everyone. Welcome to the Fanalytics Podcast, brought to you by Emory's Marketing Analytics Center. My name is Mike Lewis. I'm joined by Doug Battle. Doug, you know, it was an interesting weekend in that, and maybe I'm wrong, but I think this is the first time we've had a general popular culture moment that was focused on cinema with Barbie and Oppenheimer and what do they call it? Barbenheimer.
Yeah.
I think of anything since COVID went down where the entire culture was oriented towards something happening at the movie theater.
Yeah, the closest I can think of was Top Gun Maverick. And I think that was more universally received as far as it didn't offend too many people. But it wasn't like all over social media. It wasn't all you were seeing in terms of billboards. And
we got a movie about a scientist and about a Barbie doll, and both of them turned into completely hot button political issues with massive audiences on Twitter angry at what was happening in Barbie and mad at what was happening in Oppenheimer. So both of these movies become politically charged vehicles, and it really is this again, we find ourselves wanting to talk about, you know, the cultural analytics, for lack of a better term.
Yeah.
And everything is layered in politics. Now, I'll say two things. I didn't get to see Barbie, and I'll tell you why I didn't get to see Barbie. After this, my daughter would not go with me to Barbie. She refused. My soon-to-be 19-year-old daughter refused to go to Barbie with her dad. And again, the jokes probably write themselves, but I'm not going to go down that path.
Is it because of she didn't want to go with her dad, or is it because she didn't want to see the movie?
I don't know. Maybe both. She thought it looked stupid. But here's my point, Doug. Was 56-year-old Mike Lewis walking and getting a seat in Barbie alone? I mean, that's a terrible look, isn't it?
It's not the best look. I went for the full Barbenheimer experience.
Did you pay for both movies?
Yes, I did, because they were selling out everywhere and you had to have a seat. And I was like, you know what? I want the full experience. This will be good content too. But I you know me, I love film. And I originally planned to go with like a bunch of dudes. So it was going to be like the group of guys I would normally would watch football with on Saturdays and Sundays. Like, let's do Barbieheimer together. Preseason action, something to hold us over for football season. And two of us bought tickets, and then the whole theater sold out and the rest of the guys couldn't get tickets for the same time. So it was interesting walking into Barbie where it was an all female audience. People were dressed up for that movie. Everyone was in pink. And I'm not just talking about the ladies in the room. There are guys in pink polos, you know, kind of Barbie and Ken. It was like, wow, this is really, they had little photo ops outside. There were balloons all through the movie theater. I mean, it was truly an event. Say what?
Were you wearing pink?
No, I dressed for Oppenheimer. Okay. I couldn't do it. I couldn't, you know, if it'd been different circumstances potentially, but
let me say this. Okay, the movie looks very high end special effects. Okay, I mean, it looks visually expensive. It also, from the stuff I've seen, from the clips I've seen online, the Ryan Gosling Ken character seems genuinely very funny.
Yes.
So it has some real moments and even crossover appeal. But I've also read that they used the word patriarchy 10 times within the movie. I find it very hard to believe, and this is not a political issue, I find it very hard to believe that using that kind of language is going to work in a comedy from either direction.
Well, I've got surprising news for you, Mike. Some of the best parts of the film involved that term. Without giving away too much, I'd read that word was used like 15 times unironically in the film. And I was like, oh, this will be a doozy. And I kind of went into it. I didn't have a lot of expectations. I didn't read the reviews. I didn't watch the trailer. So I had no idea what I was going to get. And the movie starts off, and probably like the first hour, I was laughing my head off. I thought it was great. It was what I've told people, again, without getting into details of the film, as far as premise, like Buddy the Elf meets the Lego Movie meets Legally Blonde. It felt like a mixture of those three. It was really funny. Ken was a star. I think that almost too much so for its core audience. And I have to remind myself after watching the film that this film probably was the perfect film for its intended audience. And so I think that a lot of the criticisms it's gotten and even critiques that I had when I was watching it, where I personally felt like it was a really great comedy that tried to be more than a comedy at times. It was kind of telling rather than showing at times. And so that was kind of my critique from a film standpoint. And by the same token, I think the audience that it was made for, when I felt like it was being preachy or like it was being too overt in its messaging, they were cheering. They were clapping. They felt like, yes, finally someone's saying it. This is it. They felt affirmed by it. And so just seeing some of the write-ups, it just reminds me that it's almost impossible in today's age to make everyone happy with a piece of media, a piece of content. And Barbie's a perfect example where its core audience thought it was the greatest film, thought it was absolutely brilliant. And there are a lot of people who were very offended by it, who were, you know, who felt that it was hypocritical. And I've seen similar things for Oppenheimer. It used to be like there's a blockbuster movie, Star Wars. Everyone goes, it's escapism. I think this was supposed to be escapism, but it's always, you're always escaping so much when you're dealing with the same social issues in Barbie land as you do in the real world.
So again, there's nothing unifying in the culture. Right. We don't do unifying cultural products anymore, right? I mean, you referenced Star Wars, you know, Indiana Jones, E.T. I mean, these were all kind of, I mean, going back to my childhood, but kind of universal. But, you know, I guess the thing is the audience is big enough and it's so fragmented at this point that you don't have to be universal or unifying to be a success.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And so I think what I'm getting at is like, if you look at this film as an intellectual property that needs to satisfy a mass audience, it failed at doing that. And for me, because the movie wasn't made for me, I was sitting there like, man, they almost did it. Like if they had just changed this or that, it would have been the perfect movie.
A little more Ken.
I'm not saying that. Although I'll say this, I will get behind if they do a spinoff Ken movie, particularly if it were directed by, I don't know, Phil Lord and Chris Miller, who did the Lego Movie, who did the Jump Street films, who did the animated Spider-Man stuff. I would get behind that because he was fantastic. And everyone, guys and girls, love that character. Not that they didn't love Margot Robbie, but his character was special.
And I'm going to go see. I'm going to make sure that I see this Barbie movie before the school year starts.
You're going to roll your eyes at so many parts.
Also, like, you know, and again, I mean, you know where I'm coming from. It's got a weird vibe to it where I feel genuinely strange walking up to and buying it. I guess you buy your tickets online now, but buying a ticket online and going to Barbie alone. Okay. It's got a weird feel to me, but I'll do it. I will do it before we go into the next academic year. Now, here's a question for you. Barbie finished in fifth place in China for the weekend. So, you know, we know that the film industry is now truly global and you know, you got to have something for the Chinese market. You got to have something for the European market. Do you think this is going to be, is Barbie going to cross cultures as well? Or is this a US piece of IP?
Yeah, I think I could be wrong. I'm not well studied on the toys and Mattel and all that. It seems like Barbie is an American icon. In general, not talking about the film. And so I'm actually surprised that it came in fifth in China because it's smashed the box office in America. But I think that just goes to show that what's iconic in one culture is maybe not even relevant or hardly relevant in another. And I think in America, every girl grew up with Barbie at some point. Barbie and Ken, and that was part of their childhood. And so making an adult, here's another thing about this film that I think some of the criticisms didn't understand is that this wasn't made for children. I understand that inevitably there will be children who see the film. Like it's a PG-13 movie. It was made for the generation where every little girl grew up with a Barbie. And that's my generation. So people in their 20s and 30s, I think, was kind of the core audience, which was strange for a children's toy film.
Okay, but so this is kind of an interesting piece of property then, right? If this is really, did you say it was PG-13 or was this PG?
Yeah.
PG?
Yeah.
Okay, PG-13. That's kind of a fascinating thing for Barbie to do. And I mean, and so if we think about the Barbie brand, and I think the Barbie brand has probably done a lot of, you know, movement, a lot of transitioning from what Barbie was historically to Barbie being sort of recast for the modern era. Is this a bit of a, how is Barbie as this kind of, I haven't seen the film, so it's hard for me to come up with the right word, where this politicized kind of very adult oriented Barbie movie, how does that reflect on the purity of the doll for the kids? I mean, so it's a complicated intellectual property to manage. Do you think they've got it right?
I think it's tough because, like, going into it, my thought was this could totally backfire. When I saw that it was PG-13, it's like we're dealing with a brand that, regardless of the, you know, if the film's geared toward kids, the brand.
Doug, what got them the PG-13 rating?
A little language, pretty, like, they bleeped out a mother effer.
Okay, so does Barbie say the F word?
No, there's like 100 Barbies. I think one of them does, but it bleeps it out like in a fun way, like with the Mattel logo over her mouth. Spoiler alert. Yeah, there's language. There's certainly language in the music that plays. There's some language. There's sexual innuendos, I guess. Nothing extremely offensive, like a lot of stuff that only adults would pick up on, I guess. So it wasn't egregious. And I know that they probably had to be careful with that because you're making something that's got to be funny for an adult audience that has a certain sense of humor. But like I said, you're dealing with a brand where the consumed product is consumed by children, and thus the brand is really a children's brand. So it could have backfired. I don't think it did. I think it was a smashing hit. I think that the young women, at least in my demographic, like age range, are eating it up. And people who haven't even thought about the Barbie brand since they were 7 years old have been having Barbie parties and have been going with the girls to watch the movie, and will definitely have Barbie top of mind when they're having children. And will be something when their daughter becomes a teenager to enjoy with them. And so I do think it was a success in that regard.
Doug, does this thing have legs? Are we going to see Barbie 2, Barbie 3?
You know, like I said, I think I wouldn't be shocked if we saw Ken. If we saw the Ken movie being played by Ryan Gosling, and who did a fantastic job and who's universally beloved already, it seems, with the exception of him being an absolute liability in the secondary in Remember the Titans. And we will never forget that as men.
Okay. Okay. So that's Barbie. And like I said, it's, you know, the film industry obviously took major hits during COVID. It's, you know, kind of a look, I think when you go into a movie theater now, as far as I can tell, all theaters have shifted towards like these massive reclining seats, buying your tickets in advance.
It's like kind $20. Of
$20. It's kind of a different, a lot more sort of food options. It's morphed into a different product. So it's a fun industry to watch to see where it goes from here. Barbie, like I said, it's a fascinating thing to watch on a lot of levels. I mean, even you noted that people were dressing up. You know, women were also dressing up for the Taylor Swift tour.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah,
it seems to be something kind of interesting in terms of fandom getting almost more intense, you know, passing the clothing test in
place
where it used to just formerly be a sports phenomena, concerts, and now even the movies.
Yeah, you dress like the character for this one. And I'm looking at headlines for Barbie just to kind of circle back to the fact that regardless of this being a success at what it set out to be, nonetheless, it's impossible to have a property, it seems, that's a blockbuster these days that isn't divisive. Everything's divisive, including sports figures, which we talk about all the time. But Forbes magazine headline, Barbie largely praised for feminist themes, but draws anger from the anti-woke. I have read 100 articles explaining why it's actually not offensive or why it is offensive, or you know, defending certain choices that were made or picking apart certain choices. Oh yeah, here we go. CNN opinion: Barbie breaks box office records while crushing right-wing outrage. So it's a film about a toy, and it's become a political piece of ammunition.
When you read those headlines to me, my expectations of the movie drop through the floor. and it has nothing to do with being leaning in one direction or the other. It's like, why would I, you know, I mean, it's like going back to this word patriarchy. Maybe they were talented enough to use it in a clever way, but the idea of like going to a piece of entertainment and, you know, pick any movie that you truly love, pick Star Wars, pick Indiana Jones, The Lord of the Rings, and suddenly think, well, I'm going to layer in, you know, either Democratic or Republican talking points through that. Right. That sounds like something I really want to skip.
Yeah. My thing, I'm a big escapism guy. I think that's why I am and was such a big Star Wars fan growing up. I like to go to the theater and just get away from all the problems. And so when you're trying to do that and you realize halfway through that, oh, they're going to bring those back and they're going to push them on me during this, for those of us that enjoy escapism, isn't the best experience and isn't what we look for in cinema. But like I told you, like that's your take, and I have my opinions about the movie having seen it, and I had lots of thoughts that I'm not going to share. But looking at it just purely from a marketing standpoint, you have to understand, like, they don't care about you. They didn't make it for you. They made it for the people that dressed up to go see the movie and bought tickets a month in advance. And for those people, it was exactly what they wanted. And you could tell being in the audience with people's reaction. I mean, the audience was kind of interactive as far as like even cheering at times, where it did feel like you're either watching a political debate or watching a sporting event, depending on what scene it was in the film. But for its audience and in today's market, like you said, you don't necessarily have to make something that is going to unite everybody. If you can, I guess, cater to your core audience, it can be a success financially. And I think at the end of the day, that was the case for Barbie. Oppenheimer, I felt walking out of that movie like I had read an 800-page book about the Manhattan Project and Oppenheimer. And I think it's incredible that Universal leveraged the power of Christopher Nolan to convince a lot of people that this dense biopic centered around discussion on nuclear physics and quantum mechanics was going to be the guy equivalent of Barbie of what guys want. It was a dialogue driven biopic with, you know, various timelines, and phenomenal film. It's going to win awards, particularly, I think, best male actor, best supporting actor, Robert Downey Jr., and probably sound design as well, but maybe some cinematography. But that, all that to say, convincing a mass audience that a 3-hour and 10-minute film that is centered around discussion largely about nuclear physics is going to be the smash of the summer was brilliant marketing by Universal Studios, and shows the power of Christopher Nolan as a filmmaker.
Doug, I'll say this, and you know, one of the things that with the where I kind of live intellectually, kind of focusing on fandom, it's always kind of this interesting question of, you know, what is organic and what is manufactured. Mm-hmm. This weekend at the cinema felt kind of manufactured. I don't know how they actually did it. You can say that Barbie's marketing was very well done. Oppenheimer's, yes. Somehow they ended up tagging, almost like connecting to each other. This very different thing. But it really did feel like this kind of full court press by Hollywood, whatever that is, to bring back the movie industry and say, hey, you know, like you said, here's, you know, this acclaimed director, Christopher Nolan, telling this important story about a physicist. So, you know, classy, high-end intellectualism, and this pure escapism of, you know, this doll who now, you know, it generates enthusiasm across generations. And you're right. It's like, you, to be a blockbuster, you now just have to hit a certain percentage of a fragmented market. That's a good segue to sort of where we're going next, which is a lot of probably the biggest thing happening in the world of sports in the US, oddly, at the moment, is soccer. And two stories. The US women's national team has started the FIFA World Cup. They defeated Vietnam 3-0. They had about, I think it was, I think the number I saw was about, average about 5 million viewers. So again, you know, this is like, that's a solid number in terms of sports viewership, particularly for a daytime match. I think is when, I think that match occurred during the, you know, non-prime hours. But that's less than 2% of the population. Mm-hmm. Now, I will also tell you this, and you know, and some of this relates back to some of the comments you made about Disney. The U.S. women's national team is a really interesting sports story. Now, most people present it as this kind of this universal, wonderful story. Here's this amazing team that has also fought for pay equity, and you know, the entire nation should rally around them. I think the story is actually more, I think it's a better story. It's a more complicated story. When I do surveys of the students I teach in sports marketing, almost universally, the female students will say that they're, I ask who their favorite team is. Mm-hmm. The male students almost always say, you know, kind of the hometown team, you know, the Atlanta yeah. Braves or the New York Yankees. Mm-hmm. For the women, it is the U.S. women's national soccer team. Mm-hmm. Now, this is also a team that is highly political, right? I mean, you know, there've been issues with the national anthem. I think there were issues with the national anthem in the World Cup. There's been, like I said, these lawsuits about pay equity, which are very much right. in dispute about who agreed to what and if there was any real kind of discrimination or just sort of some poor bargaining by the women's team.
Right.
And so, you know, I look at this and I think, well, and look, I could argue that, well, Doug, who's the biggest baseball player in America? Mike Trout?
I was going to say Ohtani.
But okay. Yeah, Ohtani at the moment. Yeah. Ohtani yeah. at the moment.
Yeah.
Okay. Who's more recognizable, Megan Rapinoe or Mike Trout?
Megan Rapinoe.
Yeah. And I don't think it's even close. So the amount of publicity that's been, you know, pushed towards the women's national team, and again, some of this is wrapped up in patriotism, that they've been really kind of a media sensation. They've gotten a lot of positive press. They're inherently political, so it's really a strange beast when you kind of take a step back and decompose what's going on. Now, I'll also add to this, and I know I'm giving you a lot to react to. I've hated the marketing in the run-up to this tournament. Mm-hmm. I feel like most of the marketing has actually put this women's team in the place of sort of appearing as the most arrogant team since maybe the U.S. men's basketball dream team with you know, Jordan and Magic Johnson.
Right.
It is the women's national soccer team's moment. Fascinating story, regardless of if they set records at the, you know, in terms of TV viewership, if they win the third championship, really kind of a fascinating thing to watch from a cultural perspective.
Well, I think what's also fascinating, and this kind of ties back to what we were talking about with Barbie and Oppenheimer, is that nothing is universally loved. Even the national team for the United States of America, it seems, yeah. has... Yeah. It's kind of like a LeBron James effect where there may be more haters than fans. I'm not sure. There's a lot of haters and they're very vocal.
Private. Well, I see. I think they're vocal in anonymous forums.
On social media. Sure. Yeah. 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 And so, I mean, but even in the media, I mean, looking at headlines for U.S. women's national team, 2 days ago, Fox News, majority of U.S. women's national team remains silent as national anthem plays prior to Women's World Cup opener against Vietnam. That was a story that got a lot of buzz on the internet. And in the comment sections, you will see people saying, you know what, I'm going to root. I've never done this. I'm going to root against the United States team. I'm going to root for Vietnam. I'm going to root for whoever we're playing, you know, whoever the U.S. is playing.
Are the U.S. national team that has the most negative reaction within the country, right? I think there's a ton of people, but I think it's all sort of on the down low, except in social media.
Right. And except for those who benefit from their takes, you know, in the media. But with that said, there's two, like I'm reading an article and it has a quote from New York City's police commissioner saying no one should be allowed to wear the American flag and represent the U.S. if they don't believe in it. Most of them don't even know the words, talking about the Star Spangled Banner and called it an international embarrassment. And on the other side, you see a tweet that says, you know, grateful to live in a country where you aren't forced to sing or have your hand on your heart. It makes it so much more meaningful when you do it. I see the choice not to just as patriotic because of that. And so again, it's like a completely divided audience watching this.
And Doug, here's my reaction. God, that just wears me out.
it's everything.
Yeah, there is no place to hide, right? There's nothing, you know, outside of Tom Brady trying to win a seventh Super Bowl. There's nothing that we're all behind, right?
Well, I don't think everyone's behind that. I think you've got Tom Brady's a cheater.
I know, but I still think those people are sort of still kind of into it. They still kind of like Tom.
But another observation, just in terms of fandom, is that I almost feel like anti-fandom is like reflective of how strong the passion is for a team or for like a property or something. Like when you've got something like Barbie that's got so many haters, there's like an equal and opposite effect for the fans. And same with LeBron James and same with like Team USA, for example.
Okay, but let me make one more point about the U.S. women's national team and why it's such an amazing and fascinating story. So a lot of the objections to them occur based on perceptions of patriotism. Are they insufficiently patriotic? Do they dislike sort of, you know, big, you know, the MAGA Republicans? I suspect they would probably say they do. But their stardom is all completely wrapped up in the flag, because as soon as you remove the national team jersey and you go to the Women's Professional Soccer League, I think that barely exists.
Right.
How much of the brand equity of that team is from the flag being on the jersey versus from what the players have accomplished? And I think, you know, based on the success of the professional league versus the success or perceived success of that team, they are famous for the thing that they're protesting. So again, it's really kind of a strange but fascinating reflection of the times we live in.
I'll also add this. You say the thing that they're protesting. I don't know. I know there have been times where they've protested things. It almost feels fabricated, a lot of these stories. If you watch the video of the national anthem, and then you watch, like I went and watched after I saw it, I watched a video of the national anthem at the Super Bowl just for some context. Not every player is singing. There's guys that are crying that don't even have their hand over their heart or that, you know, it's like there's this hypercritical lens on the U.S. women's national team because of their past and because there are these associations with like anti-patriotism, and where it's digested. And then once there's that headline, it spreads like wildfire, and you start having conversations around the water cooler where you're hearing, hey, did you hear the U.S. women's team isn't even, they're not even singing the national anthem. You know, they're not even put their hands over their hearts, and it gets a life of its own.
Fox News, and it just becomes this kind of, you know, they became part of the culture war a long time ago. And I think once you become part of the culture wars, you can't get out, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And can we just say this? The culture wars are boring, right? I mean,
predictable. They're predictable for sure.
I mean, except for those of that really kind of live for the Fox News versus MSNBC, for most of us that want to go to a movies or a game, they're really boring and repetitive at this point.
Yeah, and it's always refreshing to have a product that is absent of that at this point. It feels like something novel when that happened. Like last year, Top Gun, Maverick, this time last year, seemed to be universally loved by just about everyone. And it was the least novel movie ever. It was like so cookie cutter from every like 80s, 90s movie. But people acted like it was this new thing because it's been so long since they saw a movie like that.
I saw that on the cruise ship, or I saw parts of that on the cruise ship. They didn't identify the enemy. So even that one, you know, they're sort of playing games to not – I guess they went in the opposite direction. They went out of their way to not offend anyone.
Well, they just told a story, and it was just good guys are going to win, and it's, you know, they kind of feel good, and there's some adversity. The guy gets the girl, just the classic, like I said, the least novel story you've ever heard, formulaic by the old formula.
Yeah. At that point, that seems innovative.
That's what I'm saying. It felt novel to so many people. It's like, wow, they didn't even. That was pretty incredible how, like, they didn't – I don't even know what the director – I don't know who he voted for after watching that movie. You know, I have no idea. That's pretty amazing. I hadn't seen something like that in a long time.
Okay, Doug. The next soccer story is Messi coming to Miami. Okay, ticket prices soar. I've seen news reports that ticket prices went up 500% for his debut. The coverage of it where he has the, I guess, the winning penalty kick or free kick, showing Serena Williams, David Beckham in the, you know, the part owner. Okay, so soccer is always banging on the door in this country, and soccer continues to make progress. We come from the Atlanta region where it has been sort of unique in terms of the Atlanta United bringing in, you know, 50,000 plus audiences on a regular basis, especially during their first few years in the city. Okay, so what do you think about Messi coming to America? And, you know, is this the next part of soccer's evolution? Now true superstardom, and superstardom is going to attract the fans? Or is this like Pele coming in the 1970s? It's something interesting, but it's not going to move the needle. And look, maybe what I'm about to say, maybe it's impossible. It's not going to move the needle to the point where soccer becomes part of the everyday conversation like the NFL.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like I've seen this before. You mentioned Pele. Zlatan was one that I remember thinking like...
Beckham came to MLS, right?
Say what?
Beckham came to MLS, right?
Yeah, I mean, he did. Always and every one star. Of these guys, when it happened, like kind of that perception that like... I remember hearing that Zlatan was the LeBron James of soccer and that... Now that he was, and I remember watching because ESPN covered it the same way they're covering Messi. It was a huge story, and it was like, wow, is the MLS on the map now?
Is he the LA Galaxy player, I think?
Yeah, he played for the Galaxy. And I remember seeing his highlights the first time, and they really made him look like incredible. And he's a great soccer player, obviously, but he was being marketed in a way that was really appealing. And I remember thinking, this might catch on. This might really get some legs and the MLS might get some momentum, and didn't really hear much about it beyond his debut and in first couple of games or first year in the league, partially probably because he's an older player. And I wouldn't be shocked to see the same thing with Messi. You know, David Beckham, of course, was another one. Like I said, I feel like I've seen it before. I don't feel like, to me, like putting in perspective, I have to look at Dwight Howard going and playing basketball for the Shanghai Sharks and think about the basketball fans over in Shanghai thinking, is this going to put us on the map? You know, are we going to be, is this going to really catch on? And it's like, well, he's just well past his prime. And he, not to say that Messi can't play in the bigger leagues, but I don't know that Dwight Howard couldn't play in the NBA in some capacity.
Here's a question for you. And the other thing that crossed my mind was, where was it? Was it Kobe's retirement tour,
mm-hmm.
where everywhere he went in the NBA, you know, Kobe's last game, ticket prices were off you know, $500 minimum. Is that what we'll see with Messi? Is he that level of, and I don't think either of us live in the world of soccer fandom, so maybe it's hard for us to judge, but you know, when he goes through Chicago, is suddenly the Chicago Fire, are the Chicago Fire going to sell out everything? And, you know, at $200 a ticket, is it going to be that kind of almost like a, almost more like a musical tour, right?
Yeah.
Than a kind of sustainable sport.
I think that will happen. And to the point of it not being sustainable, it kind of reminds me of, I was very young, but I've heard lots of stories about Michael Jordan playing for the Birmingham Barons minor league baseball team. And they packed out that stadium. And I think everywhere the Birmingham Barons go, fans from all over whichever city it was. And looking at that, it's like, did that make minor league baseball into this national pastime? You know, I mean, Major League Baseball's kind of lost its place there as a national pastime. And so certainly minor league baseball is even less of a attraction. But you know, it's more of like going to the circus or something. You go one time, you want to see this person in the flesh and just be there and be able to tell your grandkids that, yeah, I saw Michael Jordan in person. Yeah, I saw Messi. He was the greatest soccer player of all time. I saw Kobe Bryant in his last season in the flesh, and he scored 17 points and had 3 assists and 2 rebounds. And not to hate, I mean, he had some great games that year, including his last game. So not to throw dirt, but just to say, oftentimes these, you're not catching these guys at their peak, but they're packing out stadiums. It usually is a short term, not gimmick, but kind of, you know, Jordan with the Wizards.
No, and
their ticket sales were probably great, but the Wizards have no fans, no long-term fans from that.
I think it makes sense, right? In some ways, and maybe this is a little unfair, you know, I always talk about how the foundation of fandom is the stories. Maybe most of Messi's stories have been written, right? And so is there a story that Messi could essentially write in the MLS that is going to top what he's done, right? The greatness of his career, bringing a, you know, FIFA World Cup championship to Argentina. Mm-hmm. It feels like it's probably something like, oh, I saw, you know, something between I saw Babe Ruth in the flesh, or I saw, you know, I passed by Taylor Swift, right? Is that what this is? And I suspect, you know, the MLS continues on sort of this build. Maybe this helps, but, you know, I mean, what does it take to have soccer be sort of, you know, a prime sport in America? It probably takes at least another generation and genuine greatness of having the best players in the world.
I think they got to have the best players. I think there is that demand for the huge stars like Messi, but America is used to having the best in terms of sports when it comes to, and it's not that it's all American born and raised, obviously with baseball and even with basketball at this point, many of the great players are coming to America, but MLS hasn't had that until guys age out of the.
And let me say this, because I don't know that a lot of people follow soccer, right? So they may not know this. The Atlanta United was remarkably successful. I mean, filling up Mercedes-Benz Stadium just about, you know, 60,000 people on a regular basis. But the way a soccer league like MLS is going to work is that as players progress and become stars, they're going to be sold off to European teams,
mm-hmm.
right? So the model isn't even to just have like a guy that's going to be a star in MLS for, you know, 10, 12 years. It is to sort of develop talent to then sell to Premier League and, you know, the Spanish League and the German League. And so it's like, does that model work in the States? And maybe it doesn't. Maybe the only hope for soccer is they do move to this kind of super league and they put a team in New York, right?
I have several friends that there is kind of like this underground soccer community in America. There are some serious soccer fans in America, and they know their stuff and they follow it just like we follow football, basketball, baseball.
I want to interrupt you with a question. Are they MLS fans or are they European soccer fans?
That's what I was going to say. The ones I know, when I talk to them about it, they'll be like, oh, the MLS is a joke. It's like a minor league. And I watch the Premier League. I watch Manchester United. I watch, you know, and I'll keep up with the national team when they're playing, but they're really not competitive except for the women's team, which they'll get into that. And so that is where the women's team is actually kind of the best America has to offer, as far as having, we might have the best at something in soccer, and that's unique, I guess, for them. But with everything else, you know, the premium products are overseas, and they're tuning in for those games and those teams and remotely joining those fandom communities. I would imagine there's more Manchester United fans in the U.S. than LA Galaxy or Atlanta United.
I suspect that it's not even close.
Or
that
it might be the whole MLS.
Yeah, that they're more Arsenal fan. You know, I think you see more Arsenal or Chelsea jerseys, you know, if you look across the entire country, than you do any MLS team.
Yeah, yeah. So soccer's still got its work cut out for it. It'd be interesting to keep up with the women's.
But the limelight is on America at the moment, so we'll see what they can do with it.
Yeah.
Okay, Doug, last thing for this week. So apparently, you know, your New York Giants have a bit of an issue with a holdout of a running back, been a very effective running back during his early years in the league, and that's kind of the key thing. But I guess there was a conference call that ESPN has been talking about all day, involving a bunch of the premier running backs, sort of talking about how they you know, how the salary market doesn't work for these guys. And I think, you know, after, you know, Todd Gurley and after Ezekiel Elliott and after Le'Veon Bell, that, you know, the idea that the running backs are getting that big second or, you know, heaven forbid, big third contract seems like more and more of a long shot. Now, I love this topic because it morphs into something that I've talked a lot about over the years, and that's the collective bargaining agreement. Mm-hmm. The collective bargaining agreement, to make it really simple, does not work for running backs. The collective bargaining agreement, where essentially you get paid if you perform really well during your rookie years, does not work for a position where the average career and the average elite career is far less, is, you know, 3, 4, 5 years. Mm-hmm. And so I suspect that, you know, running backs probably are in the worst shape, but defensive backs probably, you know, whatever positions sort of grind people down. You know, you really get paid in the NFL on contract 2 or contract 3. So it's really set up for the quarterbacks and the offensive linemen. The running backs, you know, so what's the solution? There's no reason for the teams to pay these guys based on past performance. The solution has got to be that the collective bargaining agreement has different rules for different positions. Tough thing to implement, but that's the only way that you're going to solve the problem for the running backs.
Yeah, running backs are an interesting position. We've had guys, like I've seen players at Georgia who had their best years as a running back in college. I think Sony Michel is a yeah. But Sony Michel is a perfect example, who was drafted ahead of Nick Chubb. But I think the best football he played in his life was his senior year at Georgia. Saquon Barkley, I think probably his last year at Penn State or his first year for the Giants was his peak. Okay. Not that he's fallen off drastically, but, you know, another aspect
let me ask you, how would you react to this idea? Okay, so, you know, basically you got to have 3 years in college before you can go to the NFL. If you're at the running back position, you have to do 1 year.
Todd Gurley would have made so much more money. Todd Gurley was ready for the NFL year one in college, and everyone knew it. And he had a very short NFL career. So he played 3 years at the University of Georgia, looked like he probably would have been the best running back in the NFL all 3 years, and then was the best running back in the NFL for about 2 or 3 years. and that was it for him.
If I'm a college coach, oh God, I mean, I can't believe I'm going to say this. Something I would use in recruiting running backs is like some notion of load management.
Oh yeah. And I think that has been, you look at Alabama and Georgia, two of the like quote unquote running back U or schools that claim that, they went from a model of having a workhorse back. Gurley early in his years at Georgia was getting 20 to 30 carries a game. Derrick Henry at Alabama, Mark Ingram at Alabama, another like 20 to 30 carries guy, to in recent years, you'll have like Josh Jacobs at Alabama was like 10 to 12 carries a game and was a first round pick, didn't have as much mileage on it, was actually valued that way. And they sell the kids, they sell the recruits. And that's why you're seeing teams with 4 or 5 5-star running backs in their backfield. And they want to be with other great players because they want someone that's as good as them, so they don't have to carry the ball 30 times every game.
Isn't that great? It really tells you that it's the exact opposite of the quarterback position.
Yes.
And so yeah. Things have to be done differently, right? If there's a bunch of 5-star quarterbacks, don't go to that school.
Transfer.
If there's a bunch of 5-star running backs, you're perfectly set up. You know, maybe averaging, you know, 8 carries a game, as crazy as that is the way to do it.
Yeah, I think the having 3 or 4 guys that go 8 to 12 carries a game, I think that's like what kind of the mainstream model now. And Alabama might have started that. Georgia might have started that. I don't. There's been a handful of those quote unquote running back U schools. But you know, another factor at running back that probably doesn't get talked about enough is, so of course, as these guys get older, they tend to be more likely to play at a lower level. That's obvious. But there's this like diminishing returns at that position, unlike many other positions on the field. At quarterback, the difference in a number 10 quarterback in the league and a number 20 running back in the league or quarterback in the league is extreme. It's the difference in winning 5 games a season. It's the difference in 1,000 yards over the course of a season and a massive, you know, difference in interceptions and touchdowns. At running back, like the Giants just signed James Robinson from Jacksonville, coming off of his rookie contract. So 24, 2 years younger than Saquon Barkley. You look at their statistics for their careers, Saquon averages 4.5 yards per carry, and James Robinson averages 4.4 yards per carry. And I would imagine the difference in what Saquon Barkley is demanding and what's being paid to James Robinson is significant. So for that 0.1 yards a carry over the course of 3 or 4 years, is it worth giving up an enormous chunk of your salary? And that's just where, like, I hate to say it because I love Saquon Barkley. You know, having gone to Georgia, I loved Gurley. I'm a big fan of Nick Chubb. I want to see him get paid. But also, if it's my team, like, I'm a Giants fan too, I don't want to pay Chubb of coming up. I always want to get the guy on his rookie contract, and then as soon as that plays out, let him go, draft another running back, play him for 3 or 4 years, let him go at the end of his contract.
How about some sort of an idea where the collective bargaining agreement specifies how much you have to pay different position groups?
Why can't it just be like a free market? Just pure supply and demand? Because the running backs don't like it?
Well, because you restrict them for 5 years and their careers are 5 years long. So
yeah,
maybe running backs hit free agency. And again, you know, then you probably get into debates about, well, are you a receiver or are you a running back? But if maybe there are no team options. Running backs are free to hit free agency after 3 years. You know, I mean, all these things kind of sound crazy, but running backs get to the league after 1 year. Free agency for the running backs after 3 years would probably go a long way to actually letting them experience something of a free market at their
peak. Yeah, you would have had Todd Gurley getting a huge payday. I mean, he still got paid, but future Todd Gurley is not getting paid. Like, the next Todd Gurley is not getting paid that second contract like Gurley did. Because, like, Gurley, Ezekiel Elliott, I mean, those guys were dominating the league just a couple years ago, and Gurley's out of the league. Zeke, I have no idea what he's doing, but he's practically irrelevant at this point.
Yeah, I think he's fighting for a starting position. He might be the backup now. So
yeah, and I don't think he's too far from fighting to be in the league. Having watched him a little bit over the last couple of years, I think he's on the decline. And not to say Saquon played great football the last season. He really had a comeback year. But you're talking about a guy who's had an ACL injury in his professional career. He's 26, so like I would say maximum he's got 4 years of prime left, and that's if everything goes right. And you're likely, you know, like I said, he's averaging 0.1 yards per carry more than a guy that was a later draft pick that's a much cheaper contract. It's just, it's too much of an investment for something that is highly unlikely to be the difference in your win margins at the end of the year.
One of the things I've kind of wondered about is, you know, why does a kid like Barkley, why does he play running back? You know, why doesn't he
linebacker?
Yeah, safety. Play linebacker, safety, because the running back position does seem to be unique in terms of being the biggest meat grinder on that team, being some sort of wide receiver, right? That, you know, that athletic talent should probably try and leave the running back position because it's like you're saying, it's the marginal impact of the running back seems relatively small. So that third round running back seems just about as effective as the first round pick most of the time, and you know the careers are so short, so it's like, but it'll be, you know, I don't know where the sort of the muscle comes in terms of getting the collective bargaining agreement changed or, you know, something to make this a little bit more, and again, this is a tough word, right? Because everyone would object to this. It's nothing's going to feel equal as soon as you start making things different, but making things a little bit more equitable.
Yeah, I also, I don't know. I always put a little perspective on these things. The fact, like, we are dealing with guys that they bring a lot of value, but at the same time, it's like you can only be so upset when you're getting paid millions of dollars to play football. But I think your point about switching positions is really interesting because I remember growing up, huge Tiki Barber fan. He's the reason why I became a Giants fan. And Tiki and Rondé, the story was that they were pretty much the same football player, obviously identical twins. All growing up, both would play running back, both would play in the secondary, and Tiki ended up wanting to play running back, Rondé ended up wanting to play corner, and back then, that was when running back still, I mean, we were kind of making that transition to a quarterback-dominant league, but running back was a huge part of football. I mean, much bigger than it is now, and I remember thinking, what was Rondé thinking? He could have been this star running back. Instead, he plays corner, which to me was like an afterthought of a position. But nowadays, if you have those same twins, you tell them both to play corner because corners play longer. They get paid more. They get drafted higher because there's more scarcity at the cornerback position. There's a much larger drop off between the elite corners and the average corners than at running back. And it takes, you know, less of a toll on your body over the course of your career. And in today's age, you know, back then, I think Rondé probably didn't do what was in his best interest financially. Of course, he had a longer career than Tiki. But, you know, in this day and age, I think there's no doubt you would take the Rondé Barber, or if you're the parent, you want your kid to be Rondé and not Tiki in this market.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, I think we're going to wrap it up here. So, you know, as always, more content at fandomanalytics.com. In particular, I'm going to post an article this week that does a little bit of a dive into the elements of fan psychology, sort of starts to get at the benefits that fans get out of being a fan of a team or a film or a musical artist. And like I said, it's going to be a point of emphasis for the next several months, really digging in deep on this next generation fandom survey.